This is Morning Edition on NHPR. I'm Rick Ganley, and this is the New Hampshire News Recap. Governor Kelly Ayotte has expressed interest in expanding nuclear development in the state with the help of the federal government. But there are still questions about the local effects of nuclear power, including how to safely handle nuclear waste. The New Hampshire Bulletin's Molly Raines has been following the story, and she joins us over Zoom now. Good morning, Molly.
Good morning, Rick.
Good to have you here. Molly, the Trump administration has been pushing for more nuclear power development in the U.S., and last month, Governor Ayotte signed an executive order directing the state to create a, quote, nuclear roadmap. What plans are Governor Ayotte embracing here? What is she talking about?
Well, yes, in her executive order, the governor called for more development, and she was specifically talking about advanced nuclear technologies, which is a kind of smaller new reactor that's still years away from being commercially available in the U.S. She also recently signed on to a joint statement with all the rest of the governors in New England, saying that they consider nuclear an important source of energy for our region's future and calling for more development. And this week I learned that she also has engaged with the Trump administration on this topic because the Federal Department of Energy is looking to partner with states for some projects related to nuclear energy too.
And as you reported, Molly, New Hampshire has a history with nuclear waste. How are federal and state officials planning for waste management alongside these development efforts?
Yeah, well, the problem is that officials have struggled really for decades to plan for how we'll do that in the long term, specifically with spent fuel, which is the material that comes out of the reactor really hot and stays radioactive for a long time. And for more than 40 years, the federal government has been looking for a place to bury that fuel, and they even looked in New Hampshire back in the day. But now they said they're pivoting to try and partner with states on broader projects that could include waste management, along with other things that might be more desirable, like a new generator. And New Hampshire did submit a statement of interest to the federal government regarding a project like that, although they said they were mainly interested in a new power plant and not a waste site. But all that is to say that for now, state officials told me their plan is to wait on the feds to come pick up our nuclear waste.
Yeah, New Hampshire has one power plant, nuclear power plant in Seabrook, as you know. How does that facility handle its waste?
Well, the protocol at Seabrook is more or less what's happening at other power plants across the country. While we wait for a more long-term plan for nuclear waste, they remove the spent fuel from the reactor every 18 months at Seabrook, and they put it into a deep pool of water to cool it down. And then after a few years, the fuel's cooled down enough that it can be moved into what's called dry cask storage. And that's a big cylinder made of concrete and steel. And those are kept outside near the power plant on a big concrete pad.
A recent study from Harvard School of Public Health shows living near a nuclear plant can significantly increase the risk for cancer. I know other studies have been inconclusive, but have state or federal officials addressed these potential risks at all in this planning?
Well, officials mainly told me when I asked that the plants are highly regulated for safety. And the Harvard research is pretty new. And like you alluded to, there really hasn't been as much research as people might think into whether there are health risks associated with living near a nuclear power plant. But the folks I talked to in Seabrook, including locals, said that this points to the need for more research. And they told me they're worried and they really want to understand possible health effects before they would support additional development.
Yeah. Do you have any questions about, you know, as you follow this story, what are you looking at? What questions do you have that you want to have answered about this?
I have a lot of questions. I really want to understand more about the health impacts, both the concerns at the community level and where research stands. And I'm also curious about the costs of nuclear development or directing us in that direction, because whether that means taking resources away from renewable development or the actual financial number that we end up with.
Another potential path to more renewable energy here in New Hampshire is solar power. Lawmakers considering a bill this session that would regulate plug-in or portable solar. Molly, what does this bill aim to do for New Hampshire?
Well, portable solar is basically a smaller version of the solar panels you might put on your roof, and it's designed to be plugged into a wall socket. So this bill is aimed to make it easier and clearer, the process for getting one of those and plugging it in. People call it balcony solar, and one of the reasons it's popular is that it allows people who might rent or might not want to spring for a large array to get solar. So the proponents of this bill say it will help democratize solar energy.
I know utilities have pushed back on that. How come?
Well, some utilities, particularly in other states where this topic has come up, have raised concerns about the safety of the devices. And really, the fact that they plug into a wall is a big part of what makes them appealing. but it also carries some risks because there's a right and a wrong way to plug them into your home. So utilities have raised concerns about that, and they've also raised concerns about linemen because these are power generators and they could energize the grid even during an outage. But the proponents of the bill and of plug-in solar usually say these things can be overcome with the right regulations. And Senator David Waters, who's the sponsor of this bill, agrees.
We'll have to see how that goes. Molly, before you go, I did want to ask you about one more story. A report released last week by a National Transportation Research Group found that maintaining the state's roads and bridges would require more work than the state has funds to cover. New England weather, certainly tough on our roads, tough on our cars. What are some other contributing factors to the poor infrastructure conditions here in the state?
Yeah, potholes and weather is big, but construction materials have also been hit by inflation in recent years. And there's also the fact that New Hampshire hasn't raised a toll since the 2000s. So we have a limited budget to work with when it comes to road repairs.
Yeah, I know lawmakers considering a toll increase for out-of-staters to cover the cost of maintaining roads. What does that proposal look like?
Yeah, that proposal would raise the cost of all the turnpike system tolls in New Hampshire for folks with an easy pass that was bought outside New Hampshire. But crucially, if you are an out-of-state resident and you buy an easy pass within the state at the service center, you wouldn't be hit with the increase. Yeah. And the actual amount of the increase would be somewhere in the neighborhood of a dollar.
We'll see where
for the average driver.
Yeah, we'll have to see where that goes. Molly Raines covers energy and the environment for the New Hampshire Bulletin. Molly, thanks so much for the time this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Find more of Molly's work at newhampshirebulletin.com. The crew aboard NASA's Artemis II mission is due to splash down to Earth this evening following a record-breaking trip around the moon. John Gianforte is the director of the University of New Hampshire Observatory, and he joins us now over Zoom to talk about what we can learn from the mission. Morning, John.
Good morning, Rick.
So the four astronaut crew traveled farther than any other humans before around the moon. What was the objective of this mission?
So this mission, Artemis II, is the first time that humans have left Earth orbit and have traversed the, you know, quarter of a million miles to get to the moon, made an orbit around the moon and returned. So that's introducing people to the Orion spacecraft and the SLS launch system that gets us off the ground.
So
it's kind of a, you know, get used to the equipment, make sure everything works, and all of that.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, this technology, I don't want to say is lost, but it doesn't exist anymore. We had to kind of remake that. And at the same time, of course, you're updating that with much more modern technology and much more modern propulsion.
Exactly. And it's interesting, the computer system that landed on the moon in the lunar module, you contain more computing power in your cell phone than that computer that landed Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin in Apollo 11 on the moon in July of 69. So we've gone a long way with technology, which makes the mission, I won't say easier, but at least safer and able to do more.
Sure, absolutely. And of course, the first toilet to orbit the moon, I understand.
Which is a big improvement.
I imagine it would be. Yeah, I'm sure. I've heard some people, you know, shrugging about this, saying, you know, we've been on the moon more than half a century ago. Why is this mission so important? Now, as you said, you know, there's new technology to test here, but why beyond that? Why is this mission important?
Well, if we don't do it, someone else will. And one of the reasons why such a great big redesign on equipment getting to the moon was necessary is because the missions to the moon in the Apollo era, they were meant to win the space race to the moon. It was only the Apollo 17 mission, the last mission to the moon, that really any real hardcore science was done. Now, the other missions did return lunar samples, which had been studied since then, and we've shared those lunar samples, 842 pounds of them, with scientists around the world. But the lunar program, the plug got pulled on that because, well, we achieved the political space race victory, but the government wasn't willing to continue the missions for the purpose of science. So here we are, 50 years later, and the significance of going back to the moon is this. Since we landed on the moon, we've learned a lot about it, both from orbiting spacecraft and from telescopic observations. There's been a lot of missions to the moon with robotic spacecraft. And back in the mid-2000s, maybe 2008, 2009, it was discovered that deep inside of craters, there is water ice. Okay, so that's a big deal. Why? Because when people go to the moon, and if they have a source of water in the ice that's available in different places at near the South Pole, they don't have to bring it with them, which is a big deal because water is heavy.
Yeah, and you can't compress that either. You can't compress the water. The water has to be delivered as it is.
That's right. And remember, water is made up of two very abundant atoms, hydrogen and oxygen, which is exactly what we use in rockets for fuel. So not only does the moon contain water for us to drink, but it also contains raw material to manufacture rocket fuel from.
And that would have obviously implications if we wanted to do further missions, not only to get back to Earth, but go off to, say, Mars.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a lot of good scientific reasons to visit the moon. And sure, robotic spacecraft could handle some of that, but it doesn't have the involvement, the inspiration, just to impress and inspire us like we were all impressed when the Apollo 11 mission launched to the moon, like we were last week when Artemis II lifted off. Can you remember just how exciting that was? It just brought back memories from the 1969 mission and later missions to the moon.
And those kinds of things, too, are inspiring in general. There's a wonder to it, I think. Has there been any activity on the campus at UNH? Have you been talking about to students that have been inspired or excited by it?
I have. We have a new astronomy club here that just started in the fall semester of this year. And these kids are super excited about it. There's probably 20 or 25 students that have joined this new astronomy club. And we all went to the, or at least some of the members of the new astronomy club and my students went to the McAuliffe-Shepard Discovery Center back when Artemis II was launched. And I can't tell you how excited not only they were, the college students, but also they actually had two booths set up and they worked with younger kids to make some, I guess you could call them spacecrafts. And just that big screen they have there, we just watched that spacecraft disappear into space. It was just an amazing sight. And it was very great to see that much excitement in this new generation about exploring the wonders of our world and our universe.
John Gianforte is the director of the University of New Hampshire Observatory. He joined us over Zoom this morning to talk about Artemis II. John, thank you for your time.
My pleasure, Rick. Anytime.
You can find all the stories we talked about this morning and more at nhpr.org. And we're here next Friday with another one. I'm Rick Ganley, and this is NHPR.